Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this ninth day of September, a Wednesday morning. This hour of the program, a message for schools, for students, and you don't even have to get permission to listen. Our guest is Dr. Dan Goldhaber, a research professor at the University of Washington, an affiliated scholar at the Urban Institute, and a senior non-resident fellow at Education Sector. He has served as an elected member of the Alexandria City School Board from 1997 to 2002. His current research, looking at teacher labor markets and the role that teacher pay structure plays in recruitment and retention, the relationship between teacher licensure test performance and student achievement, and the stability of teacher effectiveness measures over time. We'll be talking about these issues and a number of others. How are we to measure the success of students? How do we inspire students to do their best, not drop out, stay in school? We'll be looking at all of these issues this hour. The New York Times had an interesting front page story yesterday, which you may have seen, that, and this hasn't been very widely reported, children, I'm quoting here, returning to classrooms across the nation during one of the most tumultuous periods in American education, in which many thousands of teachers and other school workers, no one knows how many, were laid off in dozens of states because of plummeting state and local revenue. Many were hired back, thanks in part to $100 billion in federal stimulus money. So we'll look at that issue as well. And welcome your phone calls. Did I give you the phone number? It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Dan Goldhaber, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Can you comment first on this story that was in the Times yesterday, talking about the thousands of teachers, other school workers who were laid off in many states because of their local revenue loss? Has that been made up by federal stimulus money, or is there still a shortage?
Well, it's been made up in some places. I can speak a little bit more precisely to what's going on in Washington State, which is where I live. There were a lot of teachers that were laid off, and some of them, but not all of them, were hired back. And I suspect that's the case all over the country. Different states really face different economic troubles, and so a state like California is in pretty bad shape. And my guess is that there are fewer teachers that were laid off in California that were hired back than in states that aren't struggling quite so much.
Which means students are in classrooms that are much larger this year?
Which means that students are in classrooms that are somewhat larger. I don't know how to quantify. As a researcher, I try and quantify everything, and I don't know how to quantify much somewhat, but I would guess that they are in classrooms that are a few students per class larger than they were last year.
Mm-hmm. So this is a precarious time for teachers. The federal stimulus money has helped some, but who knows what the road is ahead?
Yeah, and I think that this is not likely to be a one-time thing that we're going to see, because oftentimes the state revenues will trail over several years the health of the economy. So it may be that states are in real trouble, you know, for the next couple of years, even if the aggregate economy tends to be recovering.
Mm-hmm. I know that you do research on teacher pay structure and how it plays in teacher recruitment and retention. How will all of this play out in that area? I know some teachers aren't making as much money. Their jobs are a little more precarious. Will it be harder to recruit teachers?
Well, you know, if we were only looking at teacher pay alone, then you would suspect that if there was, you know, if there was wage freezes and other things that tended to dampen down teacher pay, that would be a problem. But really, since the whole economy is struggling, teaching is competing with other occupations for talented professionals, and so it's actually possible that teaching looks like a more attractive job today than it did, you know, a year ago or a couple of years back. And by the same token, you could argue that back in the late 90s, when there was a tech boom, that the health of the economy tended to be bad for getting really high quality people into teaching, because the teaching profession was competing with lots of other professions that where jobs were, you know, where there's a big growth in the job sector and where wages were growing pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue, and it's been so large, the huge number of teachers who leave the profession after just 2 years, 3 years, because they don't have mentors, the task may be a bit overwhelming, and the pay structure isn't terrific. Have we made progress on that front?
Well, I guess I would, the short answer is no, but you're framing the question as if teachers leaving the profession in the first couple of years is necessarily a bad thing, and I think in many cases it is, in fact, a bad thing. But there are lots of people who are also figuring out that maybe teaching is not the right profession for them, or school systems might be deciding that teaching is not the right profession for them. So some of the attrition that we see is clearly bad, i.e. there are lots of people who are very effective in the classroom that decide to leave because they, you know, they find other occupations that, you know, that pay them better, or decide that they want to go into other avenues in life. But for some of the attrition, it's teachers who are ineffective who are leaving the classroom, and that's probably something that we want to encourage.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine whether or not a teacher is ineffective?
It's a very, very controversial issue. So in lots of professional areas, there's a judgment that is made by a supervisor, and the subjective judgment is probably based on many, many different factors. That looks like it's not a system that works particularly well in teaching, in the sense that it's politically difficult to implement it. There are some structural reasons why supervisors tend to be very reluctant to make what I would consider to be apt judgments of their teaching, workforce. So what people have begun to think about falling back on are what we call value-added models, which are statistical ways of trying to tease out what is the teacher contribution to student learning. And the part about that that's very controversial is that it's usually student learning on standardized tests.
Yes.
Now, I mean, I have to tell you that I personally think that's a one valid metric of what teachers are doing in the classroom, but I think it's probably not the sole criterion you would want to use to make a judgment of what a teacher is contributing to students.
Mm-hmm. So the other measurement should be what?
Well, I think that there are many different things that teachers do that are hard to quantify in very rigorous ways, in the way that statisticians might like for, doing statistical modeling. You're teaching, you're socializing kids. You're teaching them to be tolerant of people who are different than they are. You're teaching them about democracy. We're not going to pick up those kinds of behaviors or those kinds of traits very easily on standardized tests. I think that those are the kinds of things that we care about, but probably we can't easily say this teacher is doing it, very well in a quantified way, and this teacher is not doing it very well. It's the kind of judgment that a supervisor or perhaps peers might have to make about teachers.
Mm-hmm. Or students. Students seem to know who the good teachers are, don't they?
That's definitely the theory. I mean, it's the lore. I think it's an untested lore, but it is part of the lore in the classroom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we probably need a few more lessons on how to be tolerant of people who are different, considering what's been going on in a lot of education discussions.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that.
Yeah, it's time for that. How are we addressing, as the president did yesterday, this issue of staying in school, working hard? You know, the basic messages that we've heard for years and years, but seem to be falling on deaf ears in some cases, because the dropout rate, particularly in urban areas like the one that I'm speaking to you from, is still incredibly high, and it is so hard to do anything if you haven't graduated from high school.
Yeah, and it's the just to provide you a little context, the dropout rate is high, and it's seemed to be a pretty intractable problem. So we haven't seen much improvement in the dropout, marginal, but not uniform improvement in dropout rate across time in the United States for the last couple of decades, and that's quite different from what we see around the world. So the U.S. used to be unparalleled for the percentage of kids that were graduating from high school and graduating from college. And, you know, today it's been surpassed by, you know, a good number of industrial competitors. So, but to answer your question, what are we doing? Well, we're doing many, many different things because education is primarily a function that is locally controlled. And so communities are trying lots of different things, dropout prevention, Saturday school, supplemental instruction, earlier interventions to try and catch kids who look like they might be at high risk for dropping out. But it doesn't. It has not looked like there is a sort of a single bullet intervention that works, you know, terrifically well for preventing dropouts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something we need to address in the country then, because it's hard to imagine where you're going if you don't get out of school.
No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. And what about this really setting yourself to the task? Do you have models that you've been highlighting that we should all be looking at of school districts that may not seem to be very promising at first glance, and then when you delve into it, you realize that whatever combination of factors is allowing students to really fly?
So I'm going to the short answer is that my focus tends to be on student achievement as we tend to measure it on tests, and mm-hmm. So I know less about dropout. So I want to just say that up front. I mean, I know a good deal, but it's not from my own research. But I would speculate that the things that we know make a difference for student achievement, again, as we measure it on tests, tend to be the same things that are likely to matter for whether or not a student, you know, perseveres in school. So a big factor is what's going on in the home and the community. And, you know, I don't think that is completely a part of, I think schools can have some influence over that, you know, reaching out to parents, you know, programs like the Harlem Children's, I'm missing the last word. There are interventions that focus on sort of on the whole community, and I think it's the Harlem Children's Fund is, I believe, the case. So there are those kinds of interventions, but in some respects, what's going on in the home and the community is apart from schools in the sense that they don't have real direct control over those aspects of a child's life. So what we know among schooling factors matters. It's very clear that it's teacher quality.
Mm-hmm.
That the difference between having two different teachers can be just really profound in terms of the amount of learning that's going on in a year. And so I would suspect that the difference between teachers in terms of the way that they inspire students and encourage them to stay in the classroom and persevere through high school and you know into college could also be quite profound. And I say that partially based on, you know, the many anecdotes that I'm sure sort of ring true to your listeners and are certainly true for me about individual teachers that I knew growing up that were inspirational.
Isn't that the truth? You can remember them as if it were yesterday and they have changed your lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. Let's talk just a moment about testing before we go back to schools. As you know, there's been a raging debate for some years now about and teacher complaints about having way too many tests and having to adjust their curriculum to teach to these myriad standardized tests. Do you think there's a problem in that area? We have too many tests?
Well, I guess I would say I don't think that testing in and of itself is a problem. I think that testing is a problem if we aren't using the test properly. So under No Child Left Behind, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of tests that students are taking throughout their educational career. And there's definitely some downsides to it. The upside is that we have a much better sense of how individual students are doing and how different student subgroups are doing and whether as a country we're making much progress in terms of educational achievement. But there'd be a much, much bigger upside if the way that testing was done better informed our public policy. So if we were using the tests and the gains in student achievement to do a better job of assessing, well, what kind of educational interventions are working in the aggregate, you know, so a school system adopts a particular curriculum or a school system decides to pay their teachers differently, you know, does that make a difference? And also at the more micro student level. So if we were using tests, you know, better to assess a student's progress and figure out, well, what does this student really need in order to move ahead? The student's having difficulty with complex fractions, so I'm going to alter my teaching techniques. And I think that all too often we get the testing without some of the benefits that might go along with the testing, based on the assessment of what the test scores are really telling us.
Mm-hmm. And those are hard. You almost need additional people because each student is going to have a different areas of strength and different areas of weakness, and it's very hard to individualize all of that. There's not enough time.
I think that you're right that there's, you know, capacity and time constraints are an issue, but I also think that we could be doing a much better job than we currently do now.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. They're starting to come in great number. Our guest is Professor Dan Goldhaber, research professor at the University of Washington and affiliated scholar at the Urban Institute. And we are talking this hour about our messages to schools and parents and students as the new school year begins. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Judy Shepherd will be with us. Judy is the mother of Matthew Shepherd. She is founder and executive director of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation and author of The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie, and A World Transformed. And just another reminder that we will be carrying President Obama's address tonight before the joint session of Congress, looking at health care reform. It will be starting at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Two phone calls now. Bill from Tomahawk is our first caller. Hi, Bill.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Bill.
My comment is this. I went to high school in the early 60s in New York State in the region system, and I wish your guest would talk about the region system and what it can do and can't do, and also what it does for honesty in grading, because I really think that one of the biggest problems that we have had in education is that teachers did not grade honestly and were able to get away with it, and so that created just a ton of problems. And then secondly, last year I was in Germany and got to spend quite a bit of time with a 10th grade. And she spoke to me in English, of course, although German was her native language. I think she spoke French as well. I saw her history book. It was no pictures. It was all prose. It looked like a college textbook. And I wish your guest would talk a little bit about Euro education.
All right, Bill, can you just talk, because you're the one who's most familiar with the region system. You were there. Highlight what was going on with you.
Well, as I remember the system, we got a grade from the teacher in various subjects. And then the state came in and tested us. And the whole deal was, you know, if the grade that the teacher gave us and the grade that we got on the state test didn't match up, that teacher was in trouble. That teacher could be excused in the first.
Okay, your phone just went out, but we got the gist of that. Professor Goldhaber.
Well, you know, I'm glad that Bill highlights this issue, because I think it's another important reason why we might want to be testing kids, and that is that, you know, what Bill is suggesting, grade inflation, is something that we worry about. And frankly, there are kids that would be sort of passed up through the system and would graduate without having the skills to read and write and go on to college, and that could happen if there was no external verification for what they were learning. So I don't think that this was the norm, but it's certainly the case that some teachers were passing kids along and assigning them grades that they probably didn't merit based on the quality of their work.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the opposite is true as well.
In what sense?
In terms that teachers may be giving lower grades.
Oh, sure, sure. Although I think that that's true, but there's probably more institutional pressure the other way around. Because, you know, if kids don't do well, then in some cases that's going to mean that they are held back, and that is an extra cost to the system. So I think that there's some pressure in the educational system to, you know, move kids from one grade to the next, even if they might not necessarily be ready for the next grade.
And what about his comments concerning textbooks in Germany and perhaps European countries more rigorous?
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. So the evidence on textbooks and about the sort of the curriculum is that in a lot of other countries, and I don't know how prevalent this is, but it's certainly the case when people have compared the U.S. to some European and some Asian countries with very high-achieving student populations, is that our textbooks are often a lot sort of thicker, but they are not as focused, so that there's greater depth in the material that you get in, you know, in mathematics in a single year in Japan than in the United States, where we're covering a lot of different topics, but not covering any of them in any great detail.
Mm-hmm. I got to put a word in for pictures, though. I read tons of books every year, and I go through those pictures. I'm glad they're there. Thanks very much, Bill, for your call. Tim is next from Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Three quick points. First of all, regarding teachers, I believe we need to entirely relook at education and get out of the box traditionally been in. I believe we need to go back to, like, the teacher's normal type of college. A teacher should be able to get trained in 2 years in the average high school or elementary subject. I think we ought to get rid of the total, you know, 5 years of going to college to become a teacher and tons of this non-essential education. I'd like to see teachers train with more of an internship. I know teachers do teacher training, you know, but more of an internship, teachers training, 2 year degree, and you can go teach. I don't think, and I think too much emphasis is on classroom education and teaching rather than actually being able to communicate. We've all had teachers that can't talk to anybody. They're like a monotone droid. They're not a communicator. And teaching is about communicating, and a lot of teachers just are not communicators. The second point is I think we need to look at education in America from junior high through high school. I think most of high school education in America is a waste of money, and it's a waste of time. Kids are, the last 2 years of most high school education, you talk to the average student, they say it's a waste of my time to be here. So we're housing kids. And the third point is I think we're kind of dumbing down education in America. We're testing down to make education look better than it really is, when studies seem to show, as I've read, that the longer a child stays in public education in America, the worse they do. I've talked to kids from other countries and asked them to compare American education to their education, and they say, well, it's a lot tougher where I'm from. So, anyhow, I'll hang up. And
okay, Tim. Comments. Thanks. Thanks for the call.
So I'm going to agree with some of Tim's comments, and I'm going to disagree with some of them. Some of what Tim is suggesting is actually happening in some ways. There are lots of different programs that allow people to enter the teaching profession without necessarily having gone through. Everyone has to have a college degree, so that's kind of a given. But there are programs that allow teachers to enter the profession without necessarily having gone through a formal teacher training kind of program. And so Teach for America is one of the best known of these kind of programs. And researchers look at these programs and compare them to teachers who come through traditional routes into the classroom. And in the case of Teach for America, the performance of students looks pretty comparable. The Teach for America teachers look pretty good. They're much more likely to leave the profession, but the students that they have while they're in the classroom tend to do pretty well. But I think that the way that we tend to talk about this issue around student performance, around teacher training, as if there is a monolith in the approach. And it's simply not the case. Teacher training programs vary a great deal from, you know, one from another, and I think it's pretty clear that there are effective training programs and ineffective training programs, and we need systems that do a better job of encouraging more of the effective and less of the ineffective. To the question of U.S. students and how well they do as they go through the system, you know, the students are better off staying in school longer, and the evidence on that is just very, very clear, that you're more likely to be employed, you're more likely to have a higher wage, your health outcomes are better. All kinds of later life outcomes are better if you stay in school longer and do better in school. So I kind of have to disagree with Tim on that count. He spoke a little bit about what was happening in the United States versus the rest of the world, and I think that he's right that we have a lot to be concerned about in a world where human capital has gotten to be very portable, because the U.S. educational system used to be unparalleled, and that's just not the case anymore. And increasingly, students, when they test students in the United States and compare the test scores of U.S. students versus students in Europe and Asia, today, U.S. students don't generally stack up all that well.
We go to Bill next from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Excellent show. Thank you. Is it Joy or?
Kathleen.
Kathleen. Good. Sorry, Kathleen.
Sorry.
One comment. First of all, I think the apple, there's been a point that the app made that the apples and oranges comparison of European or Japanese students to America is flawed because the school years are so different, and the education is perhaps, as you pointed out, Professor, more focused. But I wish to go back to the cultural issue, which we kind of slipped around. And the president of Teachers College in 89 mentioned that we know what makes a good education, and he listed, unquote, and he listed five factors. I'll probably only remember four, but was students' health and nutrition and things like that, ability to learn the material, and that covers many, many sins, the good, you know, good but not superb physical and safe physical conditions in which they were working in, textbooks, and then it was student parent involvement, and the last was teachers. I think that's five. And we focus on teachers and test scores, I think not looking at the really basic structural inequalities in communities. I mean, if you take the performance and dropout rates from Harlem, and where I taught for 2 years back in the, 1970-71, and you compare that with the private school environment and going through the whole continuum, you see that one does have a difficult environment. There is a higher rates of unemployment, difficulty sometime in nutrition. I had one, or psychology, or learning skills, I think. I had one young boy, Gregory Toba, who in the second grade did not know his colors or had a hard time remembering them. And I asked the guidance counselor, can we do something about Gregory? And she said, he's not really impaired enough. She didn't use that word. She used another. So there are all kinds of things that kids bring into the school with them that, A, the system is kind of forced to deal with or doesn't deal with, but would in a middle-class home or in, an upper-middle-class home would be rectified. And this gets back to, you know, all the debates about health care. I mean, how are these issues identified? And lower-income, structurally disadvantaged communities really have lower health care. And I think, you know, if you look at it in a broader sense, and I'm biased, but I think you'll see that there are other factors that America doesn't really want to address because it would be looked at as handouts or communism or whatever. And so poor communities are kind of go left to kind of be hoisted on their own disadvantage. And I think it's grossly unfair unless those to students and especially to teachers. I've been at private schools. I've taught in public schools and the university. And the teachers I had worked with in public schools and the teachers I had in public schools and a normal school in Oshkosh were every bit as good as the teachers I had in private school. Every bit as good. And the real question, the difference between them was attitude and enthusiasm. I mean, you know the skills, but they really, the most difficult aspect teachers I ran into were negative, sarcastic, and this is elementary school. There were a few in New York like that, and there are others that were very devoted and treated their children almost like their own in terms of the positive attitude they had toward them, and it showed. Hmm. Anyway, enough. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. Thanks, Bill. Professor Goldhaber.
Well, Bill is right in identifying what's going on outside of schools as having a significant influence on what students can achieve in schools. And I think that there's a legitimate argument that we might better improve student achievement by making investments in the homes and communities. Again, it falls outside of my area of expertise, but I wouldn't argue with anyone who said that we need better health care for young people in this country. I also think that it was interesting that Bill illustrated the importance of teachers and focused really not on their credentials, but on the differences that he perceived between different teachers. And that's one of the things that we see in research is that, as I said earlier, there's a tremendous difference between different teachers, and teacher effectiveness can have a huge impact on student achievement. There were a lot of other broad issues that were raised, and I think that there are lots of different ways that we could tackle the problems that students in this country are having. The one thing that I'd like to come back to is the issue of the U.S. Versus other country comparison. And it's true in a sense that these are apple and orange comparisons. The cultures are different. The school years are different. But I think that one way that you can look at this is to say, how much are we spending on education versus what is spent in education in other countries? And when you look at it that way, it doesn't look like we are necessarily getting a very good deal. And I think that part of the explanation might be something that Bill mentioned, which is the school year. It's not clear to me that the way that we structure the school year is necessarily the best expenditure of education dollars.
Meaning what, it should be longer? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a good argument. I think there's a good argument that it could be longer, but also that the very long summer break might be detrimental to student achievement because students forget things over that long a period. So that even if it wasn't actually having more days in the year, having the breaks differentially spaced throughout the year could have an impact. But in the United States, we invest much more money in reducing class sizes than we do in the length of the school year. So if you look at the school year in the United States versus the school year, say, in Hong Kong or Singapore, and also the class size, you'll see that class sizes in the United States are far, far smaller, but our school year is far, far shorter. So one might make the case that we could spend our dollars more effectively if we had somewhat larger classes, but we devoted more time to having kids in the classroom for a longer period throughout the year.
Joining us this hour is Professor Dan Goldhaber. He is research professor at the University of Washington, affiliated scholar at the Urban Institute, and a senior non-resident fellow at Education Sector. His areas are teacher labor markets, the role that teacher pay structure plays in recruitment and retention, test performance, student achievement, the stability of teacher effectiveness measures over time. And we are this hour talking about the message that we give to the country about education and messages for students on how to be successful. We have two lines open, actually, if you'd like to join our conversation. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. A reminder, we will be carrying President Obama's speech before the joint session of Congress tonight. It will air at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Judy Shepherd will be with us. Judy has written a book about her son, Matthew, The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie, and A World Transformed. She's co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation, dedicated to her son's legacy, and the organization is committed to social justice, diversity awareness, education, and equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And she speaks around the country on behalf of the foundation to promote tolerance and to curb prejudice. So that's coming up, our number two. 800-486-8655, our number. Caroline from Madison is next. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about the beginning of all this. I think that the children that come into kindergarten are vastly different compared to the kids in Japan or any other country. Because we have such a diverse culture and such a large amount of single parents and poverty. And I wondered if testing before school and some creative ways of teaching children using the visual, kinesthetic, auditory methods would help improve in education.
Well, I wish I could speak to that question. I don't know. I think we ought to be trying lots of different things, and this is an interesting idea. But it's outside my area of expertise, and I really would be just talking off the cuff if I was to answer that question in any detail.
I do have to comment that there are several early childhood studies that show that kids don't drop out if they have intense intervention in the first 5 years.
Yeah, I would agree. That I don't know about the specific types of intervention, but it's very clear that if kids are doing better in the early, you know, the early grades, that they're far, far less likely to drop out. In fact, there's a study that I recall seeing from San Diego, or is based on some research from the San Diego school system. And what they found is that how well that students do on a third grade test is almost as good a predictor of the likelihood of graduating as how well kids do on an eighth grade test. And it suggests that we can identify very early on which kids are likely to be struggling and hopefully intervene with those kids that aren't doing so well.
I'd like to familiarize you with a study called the Abecedarian study.
Uh-huh.
Abecedarian. A-B-C-D, Abecedarian study out of North Carolina that studied intense intervention in the first 5 years. It's very interesting.
Hmm. Well, I've jotted it down for future. I will take a look at that.
Yeah, and we will look at that as well. Caroline.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Chris from Waukesha. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention, I don't think the educational system will ever get better unless we really try hard on real-world application for what one learns. I myself went through the educational system, got a high school diploma and stuff like that, but it wasn't until I got to the real world, you know, in manufacturing and working, that you applied what I knew, you know, and, you know, there was a loss of interest back when I was in high school, because until later, you know, you're at a construction site, you can see the stuff you had learned, you know, the mathematics like trig and finding out, you know, static force and construction building or aggregate cement or then when you go to electronics industry, you know, you learn how the transformer works. You know, they should have some real-world application, or even the automobile, you know, tolerances for how you build an engine and apply the mathematics, you know, the everything that you had learned. You just can't learn just from the book and piece of paper. You have to apply it to the real world. And that's, I believe that's why we're in the trouble that we're in this country, $11.7 trillion in debt and the $20 billion trade deficit month after month. And we need to get the education. I mean, all the other social sciences are fine, like anthropology or communications or sports journalism or political science or history majors, but we really need to get going about learning the math and sciences, and I really want them to no interest loans for anybody interested in math and science.
Professor Goldhaber.
So I have a couple reactions. Absolutely right to point the finger at math and science and what we're doing in math and science compared to what's going on around the world. That is a real area of concern. I think it's right that there are some kids that are going to learn in a classroom setting, and I don't think that they need necessarily to have a real strong connection with what that they're going to be doing with the skills they acquire later on. But for lots of kids, it's probably really helpful to see how what they're learning is going to be applied later on. And there are programs that try to do that, you know, with some modicum of success. It's not something that's universally applied. But the interesting thing about education in the United States that makes it somewhat different from education in lots of places is that we have a very well-developed community college sector. And I guess I would argue that in many ways community colleges are serving the role of a second chance. You're out in the world, you might see how you need to acquire certain skills, and you go back to community colleges to get specific kind of training that will help you with whatever endeavor in the labor market that you are pursuing. So I think that we have some of that, though we don't have a ton of it in K-12. It just comes later on.
Thanks for your call. I don't want this hour to go by without your addressing, at least for a moment or two, the widening gap between white students and minority students, particularly Hispanic and African-American. Asian students are doing well for the most part, but this is very troublesome.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's troublesome. I don't think that the gaps have widened, but despite a lot of efforts, they sure haven't closed much. And, you know, there are reasons to be concerned about, you know, just how what it means for the achievement for those individuals that are not doing well. But I also think in terms of the social cohesion and, broader societal ramifications,
sure,
that we care about these gaps between different subgroups. So I'm not sure what aspect of that you want me to address beyond that the gap exists and it's problematic.
Well, do you feel we're paying enough attention to it? Do we know how to close that gap?
I don't think we do know how to close it. I think that there, as I said earlier, there are lots of different interventions that people are trying, and it doesn't look like there are really replicable, and I want to actually come back to this point, silver bullets. So sometimes there are things that look like they are working really well in one local context, and people try and replicate it in other contexts, and it doesn't look like it works all that well. So it's not clear that there's a one-size-fits-all solution that could be applied. There are a few programs that I think are promising. And what I'm thinking of in particular are the KIPP schools. So the KIPP is Knowledge is Power, and I believe it's a school that was originally started in Houston and has spread to other cities. And this is a school that works with pretty disadvantaged students and has achieved some remarkable success with those students, doing lots of different things. I think they hire very, very motivated teachers and getting a teacher workforce that, you know, is just super, super focused on the achievement of disadvantaged kids is an important piece of their model. They also spend more time with students that are struggling. You know, they have a, you know, Saturday school programs and extended day programs. And it looks like that just that extra time on task with people that are really focused on student achievement can make a difference, because the KIPP schools seem to, and again, it's relatively early, and you don't want to prejudge things or necessarily conclude that what's working one place will work in another, but the evidence on the KIPP schools suggests that they're working quite well and that they're doing it in a number of different cities now.
Let's go to Sally next from Tomahawk. Hi, Sally.
Hi, I just have a question about getting more bang for our bucks in the school system. And I can only speak to Tomahawk because the only one I'm familiar with. The last probably 10 years, the salaries of the teachers have risen exponentially to the lowering of the population of students. So now, yeah, they're trying to get less students in the primary grades, but they're paying the teachers so much more, it's costing us a fortune. I can speak also to my school district in California when I lived there. They instituted a year-round school, and at first the parents balked because, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do about daycare, yada, yada, yada. But you know what? The test scores improved dramatically because there was not that three-month lull that makes the kids dull, and that's the whole point. We need to get more bangs for our bucks here in Wisconsin, and we need also to demand that instead of the school districts hand us their budget and say, this is what it's going to cost us, and as taxpayers, we have no say-so. It's like having the hen, have the fox guard the hen house, and that's all I'll say. Thanks for letting me talk. Bye.
All right, Sally, thanks for the call.
Well, you know, Sally reinforces the point I made earlier about thinking about the school year differently. So, you know, I basically just agree with her. The issue of teacher pay, that's definitely in my wheelhouse, and so I'll just talk a second about that. Nobody is going to get rich, you know, going into teaching. But we have a teacher pay system that pays teachers basically in lockstep. That's based on their degrees and years in the classroom. And so that's not a pay system that's going to be strongly connected with teacher effectiveness, because it turns out that teachers get better in their first couple of years, but beyond that, there's not a very strong correlation between teachers getting additional years in the classroom and their effectiveness, nor is there much of a correlation between teacher getting a master's degree and their effectiveness. But that's a big pay bump that teachers get. So I think that one of the things that we ought to be trying is a complete restructuring of the way that teachers are paid to see if it, you know, helps to motivate the teachers that are there, but perhaps more importantly, if it might draw different people into the teacher labor market and keep different people from leaving the teacher labor market.
And that restructuring would be what?
Oh, it would be lots of different things. You know, I'll talk about three specifics. One thing is that, you know, teaching is not the same job, you know, no matter what school you're in. You know, it's very clear that if you're teaching in a tough neighborhood school, that's probably a harder job than if you're teaching in a more affluent suburb. So one thing that we might want to do is differentially pay people and pay teachers more for taking tough assignments. It's also really clear that teachers, based on the kinds of training that they received, have different kinds of opportunities in the broader labor market. So, you know, somebody who has a degree in math or science, for instance, might have, competing offers in the private sector that far exceed the kind of competing offers that somebody with a degree in English or history has. And I want to be really clear that I don't think, I'm not making a judgment about the value of those degrees. I'm just saying what the labor market realities are. So if you believe that's the case, there's a good argument for differentially paying teachers based on the kind of skill set that they have and what the private sector, how the private sector values those skills. And then lastly is the very controversial issue of connecting teacher pay to their performance. Right now, the way teachers are paid, there's really no connection. And, you know, there are places around the country that are experimenting with drawing closer connections between pay and performance. And I think that those kinds of experiments are worthy experiments.
Okay. We'll just get a comment here. We're almost out of time, but we'll just take the comment from the listener. Paul from Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, I went to a one-room school 50 years ago. And the teacher would send a note home, and your parent had to sign it. And, boy, and you'd catch hell. Anyways, you know, I had one little teacher to handle seven grades in one room. And then the family was very strong. Well, today, both family people are working now. Their priorities are money. And, therefore, they leave it up to the school system to educate their kids and to give them the standard that they needed, that they should have got at home.
And on that note, we're going to have to, it's hard to remember those one room schoolhouse days. But, you know, parents have to work, too, I think. A lot of people would like to get by on one income. All right. Sorry we had to cut you off quickly there, Paul. But Professor Goldhaber, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
Professor Dan Goldhaber at the University of Washington. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks to you, everybody, for your interesting phone calls. News ahead from National Public Radio, and we will continue with another, what should be very compelling hour. Stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.